The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Our aim is to explore the fringe, lost civilizations, alternative science, the paranormal, and much more. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live or future guests via email or the live chat room. And remember to subscribe to us on iTunes. And now welcome to this week's edition of Where Did the Road Go?
I am Soraya, your host for tonight and every night on Where Did the Road Go? Before we get into our interview for tonight, I'd like to remind you to take a look at our YouTube page, because all the shows are up there, but you may be listening to this show on the YouTube page, in which case you already know this. But for those of you who don't, or you're downloading the podcast, or have an RSS feed, or iTunes, or Stitcher, or whatever, both on our YouTube and our Vimeo page, we're going to be adding more and more video content. Right now, there are two interviews up talking about some people's personal stories. The first one, with a guy named Dave, who I've known for a while, and can personally say and attest to his honesty and his down-to-earthness, I guess you could say. He speaks of a near-death apparition, I guess you could say, an apparition of his brother, and in a haunted house he used to live in. And last night I uploaded an interview with a few of the guys from a band called Hangman's Heart, talking about some UFO encounters they had. And again, the same with Hangman's Heart, I've known these guys for a while, and I can attest to their honesty and their level-headedness. Now, if you have a story you'd like to share, please get in touch. If you're local, we can do it on video. If you're not, we can do it on phone. It doesn't have to be video. Even if you're local, we can do it anonymously. You can reveal as much or as little as you want. You can contact us through the Facebook page, or you can email us at contact@wheredidtheroadgo.com. And all that can be connected, including the email. You can find it all on wheredidtheroadgo.com. So that's number one. There's going to be some other stuff coming up. A lot of people have asked me about my own personal experiences and to expand on them a bit. So that's going to be added in there as well. I'm going to do a few videos in the locations where things happen to me. I am working on a book, which will be available eventually. I really don't have a time frame for you, which will encapsulate a lot of those experiences and what I've made of them over the years. And we'll be doing some other stuff, including, hopefully, if all goes well, we'll be going to the Parahorror Convention coming up in August. And this is a convention in Buffalo, New York, with a combination of paranormal guests and horror movie personalities. That happens August 16th at the Dnipro Ukrainian Center up in Buffalo. And among other people there, Lyle Blackburn's going to be there, cryptozoologist from that we've had on the show a couple of times, wrote The Legend of Boggy Creek and the Lizard Man book. And we'll probably be doing an extended interview with him. On top of which, there's members of Ghost Hunters International that are going to be there. The man, John Dugan, who played Grandpa Sawyer in the original 1974 Texas Chainsaw Massacre, will be there. Let's see. A host of mediums and horror movie, paranormal television show personalities will be present at this thing, including, apparently, Buffalo's original horrorcore rappers, Camp Crystal Lake. I haven't checked them out yet, but I'm very curious to see what that's all about. So you can check out the website at parahorror.com, P-A-R-A-horror.com, and we'll be doing some stuff with them and a little video feature after the event in August. All right, so for the rest of the summer, though, we have some really great interviews coming up. We have a fantastic one with Andrew Collins. We should have David Politis back on. We have the Ghost Hunters of the Finger Lakes returning, Nick Redfern, Micah Hanks. And that's about half the summer right there. Stephen Myers will be on. Yeah, so it's going to be a busy summer. We're going to hopefully have more and more video content. And if you want to help us out by donating, go to the website, wheredtheroadgo.com. And the more we can put together, the more we'll share with you. Because I love doing this. And I'm going to share whatever we can with all of you listening. And I thank you for listening and watching and for all the feedback and comments and the people who have donated and just everything. It's been fantastic so far. And hopefully it's only going to get better. And tonight on Where Did the Road Go, we have with us Dr. Lynn Kitai. How you doing?
Doing wonderful. Thank you so much for letting me share the historic and still unexplained Arizona mass sighting of 1997.
Yes, and this is easily one of the most well-documented, well-known UFO sightings probably in history.
It is. It is. In fact, worldwide now, which is very interesting because as the story unfolds, which I'm going to be sharing at the 2014 MUFON International Symposium on July the 19th, it is very interesting how it unfolded, and the media was right on it. I have to tell you, we have such a model here for what should happen. It's not treated with ridicule or cynicism or jokes any longer. They take it seriously, professionally, and it really is a model for what others worldwide should take, because what happened here not only was seen by over 10,000 people, but the data, it's the most documented, most widely seen, and really the most important mass sighting, certainly in modern history, if not all of history.
All right. Well, why don't you tell people a little bit about your background and how you got involved in the UFO phenomenon?
Yeah, it's pretty ironic that actually this fell into my lap after I dedicated my life's work for almost 40 years to community education of the reality of vital health issues. I'm a medical doctor, an MD. I also have donated my time and expertise since the mid-70s. I started at NBC in Philadelphia at KYW with Jessica Savage. She was actually my mentor while I was still in my residency, and started doing health tips, which grew into a syndication. And when we moved to Phoenix in 1980, actually they were showing my syndication, and which was pretty amazing in and of itself, and continued at NBC here, also doing health tips, and USA Cable as well. And by the mid-80s, was seeing adolescents in our practice, family practice, that were drowning in substance abuse and wanted to do something productive and really fun for them, to wake them up to the reality of substance abuse. And started actually doing curriculums, video and workbook curriculums for the classroom, which, by the way, also had AIDS and teen pregnancy that was so successful, and they've won all kinds of awards and now being distributed internationally by Discovery Education. So by 1997, I have to tell you, I really had a big background in community education worldwide, but I had no education in this topic at all, had no interest, had nothing, really. I mean, I actually stayed away from it because of all the horror stories. We get into that in the documentary, and also in the book, on how we're so inundated with threat, and harm, but I really had no interest. It just in bringing up two young boys to be productive, caring adults, which they are, I really didn't have time for it. And here in 1995, 2 years before the mass sighting, and this is really important in the whole storyline, because my husband, who's also a physician, and I had a very close sighting, he's from Philly as well, a very close sighting to our home in Paradise Valley. We live high on the mountain overlooking the city skyline, so we know what planes look like, and helicopters and streetlights and car lights and so forth. Well, these were a little below us, behind a private gated area, three orbs in a triangle pyramid formation, about 50, 75 feet above the very treacherous desert area. And I have to tell you, I mean, it was like nothing I'd ever seen or even conceived of having here on Earth. And as I stared at them intently, trying to take everything in mentally, the size, the shape, the color, they were about 3 to 6 feet each, depending on how close they were, and they were pretty close. They were oval-shaped, like an egg on its side, and there were three distinct objects, one on top and two closely aligned underneath, and I call them an orb. And again, I always go back to this sighting because the light did not extend outside the edge. The light was self-contained, and it was a uniform amber color throughout. It didn't glare at all. It was mesmerizing and soothing. And I thought to myself, if I don't get a picture of this, no one's going to believe it. And I go running to the closet to grab my camera because I take, I collect sunsets, and I have some UFOs and sunsets too on the photo page. If anybody wants to check out the photo page on the PhoenixLights.net, www.thephoenixlights.net, Phoenix Lights Network website, it's a pretty unique collection, and I have these pictures as well because as I'm going to grab my camera, my husband calls me back. He says, get over here quick. One of them is disappearing. And as we watch together in awe, the top orb, without budging from the other two, started to implode like a dimmer switch very, very slowly, as if there was an intelligence behind it. It was so mechanical. And we saw it disappear into a pea size, and then suddenly it was gone, but it felt like it was still there. And, you know, it was just an extraordinary feeling. And I jumped out on the balcony, took a quick picture of the two lower orbs, and immediately noticed an eerie silence as if time had stopped. It was just bizarre. And going through my mind, and I didn't share this with us all until 2 years later, after the mass sighting in 97, I was thinking to myself as I stood there on the balcony, and it felt as intently as I was watching these two lower orbs that something was watching me. And I thought to myself, who are you? What are you? Do you know that I'm here? I'd love to meet you. And the next thing I remember is the left bottom orb started to implode, just like the top one did. And I quickly shot a picture of that. And if you go on the photo page, it's right there. It's an amazing picture because I happened to catch this in progress. One half disappeared and one's still there. And I didn't even know who to show the picture to, I have to tell you. And by the way, MUFON has been very involved with this whole thing, and I'll share that as well in my presentation, because 2 years later, I mean, I wondered for 2 years what this advanced technology was right outside our window. I had no clue what it could have been, nor did I know anyone that was involved with the topic. So I just wondered until 2 months before the mass sighting. And again, this is really important data, and I always think the data speaks for itself. Just look at it, because 2 months before the mass sighting, suddenly these orbs started appearing after not seeing them for 2 years, and we have one wall of our bedroom as a window. So whenever we're in the bedroom, if whatever turns up out there, we get to see, and we didn't see anything even remotely similar to these orbs until 2 months before the mass sighting, when, again, I saw three orbs in a row this time, far west, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, they're amber, they're big balls of light in a row, equidistant row, and they hovered for minutes. I thought, strangely similar to 95, and I watched each one as it imploded from the outside inwards again, right to left, and they were gone. Well, the next night, my husband was at a medical board meeting. He was on several hospital and medical boards, and I noticed the same three orbs at a distance, but now they're in front of South Mountain where the airport is. And I thought, oh my goodness, I've got to get my camera and get a picture of this. And I grab my video camera, get out to the front area, and as I'm shooting, I got about 18 seconds worth, these three orbs, suddenly my battery went dead, and it was charged, I have to say. So I ran inside, I hooked up the battery, ran outside, they were gone. This was about 8 o'clock. At 8:30, my husband comes up the drive, and I go out there, and I said, honey, remember I told you about the three orbs far west last night in a row? Well, about a half an hour ago, they were right in front of South Mountain, and there's red blinking lights in front and on the mountain to warn planes coming into Sky Harbor, and they were definitely lower than them. And as I'm pointing with my hand out, they suddenly appear in the same spot. It was really freaky, and I said, oh my goodness, I've got to get a shot of this, and I run upstairs, I grab my 35 millimeter, I get out onto the balcony. As I'm ready to shoot the three, suddenly six pop up on top of the three, massive span, over a mile wide. And I was shaking. Actually, the first picture of that series is a little wavy because I was shaking. I have to tell you, not having an explanation for 95, I didn't know what we were dealing with. Was it a mothership or a fleet or whatever? But anyway, I started shooting away and actually ran inside to call the newspaper to tell somebody to get out there to tell me what the heck it was. And they were gone the next morning, and I did not sleep well that night. I called the Arizona Republic again, and I said, did anybody see strange lights last night in front of South Mountain? And the operator gets off. She gets right back on. She said, nope, nobody called. Well, I know I called. So I said, well, you know, we saw some strange lights. Do you know of anybody that might know what they were? She says, well, sometimes Luke Air Force Base sends out experimental maneuvers, and maybe that's what they were doing. They don't tell the public about them. And I thought, that sounds reasonable, but let me check it out. So I call Luke Air Force Base, and I have to tell you, the operator from the get-go had an attitude. And she said, I tried to be professional and said, my husband and I are both physicians. We saw some strange lights, massive span over a mile wide in front of South Mountain last night. Do you have any idea what they might have been? And she says, well, nobody, they didn't come out from Luke Air Force Base, and they didn't come into Luke Air Force Base, so we had nothing to do with them. And I said, well, be that as it may, somebody must know what they are. They were massive. And she says, well, you said it was in front of the airport. Maybe they saw something, the air traffic controller saw something. So I said, well, that's a great idea. Now it was a mission. I had to find out what this was. So I called the airport, right? I called the airport and got the FAA on the phone, and they were really nice. And the gal said, let me ask the air traffic controller. She left me hanging for about 5 minutes. Finally, when she came back, she said, actually, there were a group of air traffic controllers here last night that saw some strange lights, and some of them are here this morning. I said, oh, could I please talk to them just to confirm that we saw the same thing? Well, finally, one of them got on, and he's a really low-key guy. Got to meet him afterwards, and he was more excited than me. He said, did you see those X-rays? He put this in some other hovering information last night about 8:30. I said, yes. He said, actually, we saw three at 8 o'clock. I said, I did, too. He said, he couldn't believe that I saw them, and he was really excited that I saw them at a distance. He said, by the way, they were, and he was very forthcoming at the beginning, they all were. By the way, they were over Class B restricted airspace, okay? They appeared over Class B restricted airspace, which is a 30-mile radius around the center of the airport where anyone that comes into that radius, particularly at 1,000 feet altitude as these were, must call into the tower, and no one did. So they got alarmed, and they looked on radar, did not show up on radar. So they took their binoculars to look, and in their own words, they described them as six points of light, totally equidistant from each other, massive span over a mile wide, that seemed to be attached to something, but they couldn't quite see what it was attached to. And you would hear this again a month later, 2 months later, during the mass sighting. But one of them was a meteorologist and said that it actually turned as a unit against the wind. And that's when I actually was taking the pictures of it head on, turning into a V-shape, and then elevated as a unit and went slowly behind South Mountain, which is south of the airport. So I said, so what was it? And there was silence. And then one of the air traffic controllers said, beats me. And I said, you're air traffic controller. You're supposed to know it's in our airspace, and you don't know what they were. They had no clue, and they ruled out every conventional possibility, from flares to balloons to lanterns to whatever. And we kept in contact, continued to photograph these lights up into and including the mass sighting. And there were other people, I have to mention, that were also seeing them for days before. In fact, serendipitously, and again, from day one, I had a relationship with MUFON, because about 2 weeks before the mass sighting, I finally was getting ridiculous, and I had to find out what these were, and I asked around, and this is how close I was. A friend of a friend had a neighbor who had a friend who knew the past president of MUFON, and I said, great, let me give him a call, which I did. And he hadn't heard about these other lights, but he refers me to a field investigator who I made an appointment with the following week. On Wednesday, he calls Tuesday to say that the then director, Tim Taylor, I believe his name was, couldn't make it, and he wanted to be there because his mom had passed, and the funeral was that Wednesday. Could I fit it in some time else? So the only window of opportunity I had actually was Friday morning at 10 o'clock on the 14th, and he said, that's fine. Well, unbeknownst to me, the night before was the mass sighting. I had no idea. To me, it was just another night. And what was really interesting is that the same exact formation. Actually, I saw one lone light about 8:20, and that's when calls were coming in from Paulden, Arizona. The first official call, even though we found out much later that people were seeing them from 3 o'clock in the afternoon that day. And actually, the day before, I should mention this, on the Navajo Nation, they had a big sighting up there, which was very interesting, by the way. Huh. But at any rate, about shortly after 8 o'clock, there was a call, the first official call that the media would talk about, from a retired police officer in Paulden, Arizona. And that's when I was seeing this one lone light far west. About an hour later, I see one lone light far south. And that's when people were seeing these phenomena far south near Tucson. And it was shortly after 9:30, I see the same exact formation pop up in the same exact location as 2 months before. Run outside with my camera. By the time I got it focused, I ended up getting 3 points of light, like the end points of a giant V or triangle, over a mile wide. And I was really excited that I had gotten something on video to show the MUFON researcher, investigator the next day. I walk in to his house at 10 o'clock in the morning the next morning. The first thing he says to me is, did you see the big sighting last night? And I said, well, I saw something similar to 2 months ago that I told you about. He said, no, you don't understand. Hundreds, if not thousands of people statewide saw either these lights that seemed to you, these orbs that seemed to be attached to something, or actual craft. And NBC was coming to interview him in a half an hour. And I said, whoa. I used to do health reporting for NBC in the early 80s. They might recognize me. I don't know. But that doesn't matter. It's not about me. It's about the data. And it's never been about me. It's always been about the data. I said, you know what? I'm out of here. I don't know if it's military or a hoax or whatever, but it doesn't matter. Take a copy of my video and please share it with whatever media you would like to share it with. Well, what's really interesting, I left and I called the air traffic controllers, and they had also seen the same thing at the same time that I did the night before during the mass sighting over Class B restricted airspace again in the same place, which was pretty amazing. And in the meantime, I was watching out to see what would happen with the news. And I was getting calls all day long, but I just was not interested in getting involved at all with the media. And by 4:30, the first newscast of the day, my video was plastered on every news station. It was unbelievable. I have to tell you, it was really exciting because not having an explanation, I mean, here thousands of people had seen what I was looking at, you know, not only witnessing but photographing. And something really spectacular happened that night. And I tried to keep track of every media report by the evening news. By 9 o'clock, two other videos had come forward. And they were pretty spectacular, even more spectacular than mine. One is an arrowhead. And all you have to do is look at the video. Those lights are attached to something. And then that video and my video, by the way, were shot before 10 o'clock. After 10 o'clock, there were two videos that were boomerang videos. Now, they have come under fire for being flares, but that's a whole other story because what happened after that, I have to tell you, the TV media was right on top of it. I mean, they covered these things for months, and there was no investigation, no explanation. In fact, it wasn't until a week after the mass sighting where I'm looking at another news report, and they're interviewing a fella who was right here in Tempe, which is right near ASU, at Village Labs, Jim Delatoso, who had this computer lab. And he also, on the side, analyzed video and pictures of UFOs for like 20, 30 years, and he was showing from his vast database the same exact thing that my husband and I saw, these orbs in triangle formations from all over the world. That was the first I heard of it, by the way, from Russia and UK and Belgium. And I mean, there's such a history of these similar phenomena. And that really blew me away. And at that point, I knew something was going on. And it really sent me on a journey for the next 7 years, which I stayed anonymous, but I kept a journal every single day because I was searching for a logical explanation of the history of these phenomena, similar phenomena worldwide, of media reports, as well as witness testimony, and ended up with a 750-page journal. and finally, wow, had to decide, what am I going to do with this? And you can only imagine, as an educator and also as a scientist and as a physician who knows that other people must experience things, and most things can be explained. Most anomalies can be explained. Only a small percentage cannot. But when somebody has an experience that is extraordinary, it's real to them. And if you don't share it, it festers. It's not healthy. So that was another component that I had to consider, because I experienced it too, up close and personal, and actually photographed it. I couldn't be talking to you now, by the way, if I hadn't photographed what I did, which I went to extreme lengths to have explained to me at university level, at military level. And to this day, I have to tell you, nobody can tell me what they are. They can tell me what they're not, but they are true unknowns. So I have actually the only 35-millimeter of the Phoenix Lights to this day that we know of, and one of the handful of videos, which is really the only one that has been authenticated by Navy optical physicist Dr. Bruce McAbee, as well as Brooks Institute of Photography and U of A, University of Arizona Optical Science Department, and others, as a true unknown. So what do you do with that, right? So after 7 years of soul searching and a 750-page journal later that I condensed into the best, most compelling data, 250 pages of the most credible data that I had compiled, finally, I thought to myself, I cannot stick this in a drawer. It is what it is, and I came forward in 2004 and continued to document media reports, by the way. But once I came forward in 2004, you can only imagine. and I had gone back to work. By the way, I pushed my whole medical career aside for 4 years and went back to work to help put our younger son through medical school as a chief clinical consultant at the Arizona Heart Institute Wellness and Imaging Center while I condensed the book. And when I finally came forward, I was just overwhelmed with the positive response when people actually looked at it, which was amazing. And because I really tried to do the homework, not only for myself, but for others. And I haven't stopped.
Were you worried about coming out publicly? Were you worried about being ridiculed for it?
Oh, are you kidding me? I mean, look, I'm a medical doctor, pristine reputation, and actually very accomplished in the medical field as well as in the medical communication field. And it was really taking a huge jump and a huge step to come forward. I didn't know what the reaction would be. It certainly was very in 97. And even leading up to 2004, in that period of time, and I'm going to be showing how the media changed here in Arizona, because even though the TV media was very open, and especially when they found out, because they used to call the person who Village Labs had named the person who had the pictures Dr. X. Nobody knew who Dr. X was until I came forward in 2004. What was really cool was that when I was doing health reporting in the early 80s here, a lot of the people I worked with were just starting out. And when I came forward in 2004, now they were the head of the news department at CBS and the head of the production company at ABC. And it was like, your Dr. X will come on over. And it was unbelievable from day one. They really embraced me with open arms. The print media was not so kind to many, many people that came forward, including Frances Barwood, Councilwoman Vice Mayor Frances Barwood, who was the only one. And again, there was no investigation, no explanation. And it wasn't until May that she was in a council meeting and she had so many of her constituents ask her why there wasn't an investigation, and she was only doing her job. She didn't see it. She just was asking on behalf of her constituents why there wasn't an investigation, and she got plastered. I mean, I'll be showing some of the things that happened to her, but I have to say that there wasn't anything that really happened outside of Arizona until June 18th. That front page USA Today article opened our sighting to international scrutiny. We were deluged by media. Overnight, it went viral, and we didn't have social media in those days. This was in 97. This was June 18th, 1997. And every morning show, Peter Jennings, Dan Rather, I mean, it was just overwhelming. I mean, I couldn't believe it overnight. And it was the first that anyone outside of Arizona really heard about the mass sighting. And by the late morning, this is really interesting, on June 19th, our former Governor Symington, Fife Symington, called a press conference to say that he found the culprit of the lights over Phoenix. Mm-hmm. The first time anyone had said anything in the media concerning that. And everyone took him seriously, I have to say. And by the afternoon, he has this press conference and marches out one of his aides in a giant alien head costume and made a mockery of it all.
Yeah, I remember that very clearly.
Yeah, which was very disconcerting, particularly to parents who were with children. And, you know, just to give you a little flavor of what people saw, I mean, we're talking a mile to 2 mile wide. Again, either these lights that seemed to be attached to something in a V formation, whether they were separate and had a force field in between, or actual craft. Now, let me go back to that, because if you go to the website, the PhoenixLights.net, Phoenix Lights Network website, and go to the GAP page, G-A-P, Geospatial Animation Project, you'll see after a 12-year compilation of thousands of reports to the UFO Reporting Center in Seattle, Washington, to Arizona MUFON, to Councilwoman Frances Barwood, who was also the vice mayor at the time, as well as Village Labs, compiled by the investigators. There were actually 8 or 9 different craft that people reported, and they were very different. And if you look at those pictures, the illustrations by Larry Lowe are just excellent, and they really describe what people were reporting, and whether it was one craft that could morph into looking differently, or the perspective from where the person was standing, or an actual parade of different craft. And I have to tell you, that was the conclusion that the investigators finally came to, because there were many things happening. You know, most people have no clue, unless they read my book, of what really transpired here, because it wasn't just one or two events. It was many events simultaneously in many different areas, and not just in Arizona. They were also being seen in New Mexico, California, and Nevada. We have a pilot who contacted me to let me know confidentially that she was flying a commercial airline from Phoenix to California about 11:30 that night. And as they were approaching Nevada, Las Vegas area, they see this thing covering Las Vegas. And she calls the radar people to ask if they're seeing anything. And almost simultaneously, another pilot calls in all frantic that this thing was over him. What is it? And suddenly a strange voice comes on the speaker and asks them for, you know, details of what's going on. And it freaked them out. And they said, we really didn't see, we must have been mistaken. And they were freaked that this other voice came on that was very authoritative. About a half hour later, they're approaching California at 30,000 feet, and they had 140 passengers, and everyone saw this. Suddenly, there is a ball of light to one side of the airplane, and they realize that it was a flare. And suddenly, on the other side, very close, they said less than a half a mile, with a military jet going in the opposite direction with afterburners on. And they really got freaked out. I mean, they felt, and actually this was shared in one of the MUFON reports, by this pilot. They felt that somebody was really trying to warn them to keep it, you know, buttoned. But at any rate, the next morning as well. Well, first of all, let me say this: it's 3 a.m. the following morning. There was a call to the UFO Reporting Center, and we have some of that tape. It was taped and recorded. And we have some of that recording actually from the source, a crewman, an alleged crewman from Luke Air Force Base called Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center in Seattle to report in great detail that that night, about 8:30, one of these objects was hovering right over Central Phoenix at 7th Avenue and Indian School, and military jets were sent out to either intercept it, get gun camera film, which I have heard that they did through sources. And as they got closer, the lights started to dim, and then suddenly the whole thing just blinked out and disappeared. I mean, we're talking incredible technology here. And actually, his crewman said that it freaked out one of the pilots. He was so freaked out by it that he had to help him out of his aircraft. And then at 5:30 the next morning, there were actually a Boeing crew reported to me that they were coming in to work at Sky Harbor International Airport, and one of these objects was hovering over their tarmac. And we're talking not only many hours and many different objects and many events happening simultaneously, but those that saw it right over their head. And we have a wonderful pilot in the documentary who, in detail, talks about looking into the well, these giant light wells of like swimming energy. I mean, he was right under it, and as were many other people. And some people actually saw these lights detach from the main object, go out into the environment, and then redock with it. And others saw it take off at blink speed, totally silent. It didn't even displace the air around them. So, I mean, we're talking incredible technology, to be sure. And today, I mean, do we have this kind of technology? I've never heard of it.
Well, I think if we did, it would be deeply buried in black projects somewhere.
Well, we're talking 17 years since this happened, over 17 years. You would think we would have seen an inkling. But what's really impressive, I have to say, is that there are indications of this technology, particularly in indigenous cultures worldwide, since human documentation began. I mean, that's what's so amazing about this story, because these phenomena have been around for centuries. In fact, another serendipity, and I have come not to believe in coincidence, 6 months before the mass sighting, I was invited to present my substance abuse prevention education program at the Gila Bend Indian Reservation, which is actually in a basin in between South Mountain, and if you go on the photo page, you'll see that first picture. You can see South Mountain on the left, just south of the airport. But a few miles back is the Estrella Mountain Range, and they intersect at one point. And right where they intersect is where the Gila Bend Very Sacred Ground is located. And after the mass sighting, I happened to notice that these phenomena were popping up in that area, and I thought maybe they saw something, so I called. And they didn't usually talk to outsiders, but I got friendly with them and helped them out. And I said, did anybody happen to see strange lights on March 13th? And they started to giggle. And I said, is that funny? And they said, are you kidding? We've been looking up at them for centuries. We call them sky beings, light people. I mean, this is what they've had in their culture for centuries. In fact, there are petroglyphs right on South Mountain and the Estrellas. These are etched out drawings of the same thing that my husband and I saw outside our window, the pyramid of three lights, and what I actually photographed on and filmed on March 13th during the mass sighting, as well as the boomerang, I have to tell you. And that's really come under fire for being flares. And that was the only explanation that was ever forthcoming about a month after the USA Today article. So we're talking June 25th, okay? In fact, June 24th, I got a call because I had contacted every military base statewide. I really was trying to do my homework and to see what they knew or what they thought. And they were just as curious as we were. Not one of them had a clue. And some of their conversations were quite comical. I share some in my book. But I get a call on June 24th from one of the heads of PR at the Air National Guard. And she says, oh, Dr. Lynn, I think we know what those lights were back in March. And I said, you do? I was excited. I wanted to know what they were. And she says, do you believe in almost 5 months, nobody ever looked at the log for visiting Air National Guard, and the Maryland Air National Guard was in town sending off flares in Operation Snowbird, which I later found to mean in military terms diversionary tactical maneuvers, which it has been a diversion ever since they came out with it. But anyway, she said, that must be what some people saw. That's exactly what she said. And I said, well, wait a minute. When was the Maryland Air National Guard in town? She said, March 1st to the 15th. I said, were they in town in January? She said, oh, no. I said, are you sure? She said, absolutely not. I said, well, I have 35-millimeter photographs of the same exact phenomena in the same exact location confirmed by air traffic controllers the next morning as hovering over Class B restricted airspace at 1,000 feet altitude. And she says, you never told me that. And then I said, besides, you're trying to tell me that flares that cannot keep a formation, that drift and drop with the wind, have huge smoke trails that are illuminated by the flare itself and illuminate the area around it, which, by the way, not one witness to the Phoenix Lights described that, traverse the entire state in a rock-solid, mile-wide, equidistant V formation for hours. And she says, I have a call coming in. I'll get back to you. Well, I'm still waiting.
Nice.
And that was the only explanation that ever was forthcoming. I have to tell you, the next day, in the paper, it was plastered in the front page that the Phoenix lights were flares. Well, to continue the story, which is really interesting, after they came out with that explanation, it was like, okay, I'm looking for a logical explanation, as were others. Fine. If it's flares, then do it again. I mean, I knew I had pictures not only 2 months before the mass sighting, but when we went back to analyze the pictures from 95, the close sighting, I was so focused on the close orbs, never noticed. And all you have to do is look at the data, look at the pictures. The same exact phenomena is in the same exact location in the distance there as well. And by the way, the Gila Native Americans in that area told me that the Estrellas got its name. It means star in Spanish, because in the day, all the stories for centuries of these orbs and these lights appearing in that area. So they called it the Estrella Mountain Range. And they believe there is a gateway or portal in that area. And I'm not saying if there is or isn't, but just look at the data again. These phenomena keep popping up in that same area. But at any rate, I have pictures that prove that whoever did it multiple times. And after, by the way. Some amazing pictures after March 13th. So do it again. Well, it wasn't until right before the third anniversary, on March 7th, 2000, that suddenly three Air National Guards announced that they were coming to show everyone the Phoenix lights. And I'm going to be showing some video from reports of just that. And it was a joke. I mean, it was so different than the real deal that anyone that saw the true unknowns knew immediately that it was definitely not flares. And to this day, it's still unexplained.
All right. Well, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Dr. Lynn Kitai.
The opinions expressed by the host and guests on Where Did the Road Go are their own and do not represent those of WVBR or its management. Join us on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com, where you can send us questions for our live guests via email or the live chat room. You can also check out our upcoming schedule, blog, link section, book reviews, videos, and links to our Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, and much more. That's wheredidtheroadgo.com.
And you're listening to Where Did the Road Go? And tonight's guest is Dr. Lynn Kitai, author of The Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Alone. And you're going to be speaking in 2 weeks at a MUFON conference. You want to tell people a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. It's really exciting to me that I'm going to be able to present a whole totally new presentation on July the 19th at 3 p.m. at the MUFON International Symposium. Really honored to be part of this because there is so much more to the story. And one of the really integral components of the Phoenix Light story is how the story unfolded through the media and how the media treats it here in Arizona, treats all sightings. They really take them seriously. And there's some that can be explained very easily as blimps or Chinese lanterns or whatever, but there's no more snickering, there's no more laughing. They really do take this topic seriously because we've seen it. And so many thousands of people have actually been involved with the Phoenix Lights phenomena that it has changed the consciousness here. It has really raised the consciousness that something is going on, that something is visiting us, that to date it is still unexplained, and that it's happening worldwide, and it has been happening for not only decades but for centuries. So we're going to get into all that and actually show the reports themselves, which are pretty neat.
Okay, and where is the conference?
The conference is being held in Cherry Hill, New Jersey at the Crown Plaza Resort. And for anybody that wants to find out about it, actually, if you're on Facebook, you could go to the Phoenix Lights Network, Phoenix Lights Network Facebook page. I have all the information there. And I hope people visit us as well because we have lots of information to explore and consider, as well as the website, the Phoenix Lights Network website, www.thephoenixlights.net. And we have it there as well in the events page, all the information that you need to get involved. And I hope people come and visit, particularly since my hometown is Philadelphia, which is right across the bridge, and anyone that's listening in that area, I hope they'll come and see what it's all about, because this topic and the speakers that are involved, there's some wonderful, wonderful speakers that are headlining this year, and I hope they'll come and listen and learn, because that's what it's all about.
All right. And do these experiences in Phoenix, these Phoenix Lights, have they reoccurred in like waves?
Actually, it really, you know, happens periodically. I have to say that, again, if you go on the photo page on the Phoenix Lights Network page, you will see the photo page there, some incredible pictures of these unknowns that have occurred throughout the years. We're still seeing them, and I get reports all the time from people, you know, all around the state that are seeing these phenomena, particularly over Native American land, which is very interesting. They have a lot of activity in the Navajo Nation. Not only do we have a documentary now, which has won over a dozen international film festival awards, and we share some of that in the documentary as well, and astronaut Edgar Mitchell is in it, and he talks about it as well, and some wonderful, wonderful people, 911 police operator and military and pilots and all that good stuff. But they're also guests of ours. Every year we have a celebration of the anniversary. And this past year we had some Navajo Rangers who are working with Arizona MUFON. I mean, talk about a big step forward, which is absolutely incredible that here we have law enforcement that are taking these sightings seriously and using their own tools as law enforcement to you know, get out there and really investigate these sightings and the you know, and what's happening out there. So you know, that's a big step forward too. But I do hope people will come to the conference. We have big names, you know, Ben Henson from the Factor Fiction show, and certainly we have journalist Lee Spiegel is going to be speaking, as well as Bill Burns and Linda Moulton Howe and James Fox, who has done some movies as well and includes the Phoenix Lights in his movies, as well as a whole host of other wonderful speakers.
George Knapp as well.
George Knapp and Steve Bassett, as well as John Ventre, who's very involved with the MUFON, the new MUFON show now that's being shown on TV. So there is so much to learn about this topic. I had no idea. Once I started looking, it opened up a whole new world for me. And that's why I came forward. It's intriguing at the very least, and it's important at the very most. And just an honor to be able to be included in the company of these wonderful speakers. And I hope people will come out and listen to what they have to say.
All right. When's the last time you saw one of these things?
Actually, the last time that I personally saw them, I think it was 2005. They're happening all over the state, and there's people. You know what's amazing? I have to share this. When I first came forward in 2004, and I have to say, with great apprehension, but it's been such an adventure ever since. The official and accepted explanation, except for the witnesses, of course, and the investigators, was that the Phoenix lights were merely military illumination flares. They never addressed the craft, by the way. But we have really come full circle with social media, with the other media. And I have to say, this year, it was overwhelming with the media coming out of the woodwork from Travel Channel, History Channel, National Geographic, besides the local media. But we're talking French TV, India TV. I mean, they're really hearing about the Phoenix Lights, and even if you go on YouTube, you'll see it's unbelievable. People around the world, and it's not just me. It certainly is other people that have come forward as well, including, which is very interesting, right after the 10th anniversary of the mass sighting, our former Governor Symington, who had mocked the sighting the day after the USA Today article in 97, came forward bravely to say that he actually saw it. He actually saw one of the craft, and that it was otherworldly, in his own words. And that's a giant step as well, because the more credible people that come forward, and I hope that my work has helped other people feel more comfortable in coming forward, because it is what it is, especially if you can capture it on film. We've come full circle, because now people worldwide will see similar phenomena, these orbs or these triangle V-shaped craft, and they'll look up and say, whoa, there's the Phoenix Lights. And you hear it over and over again in YouTube videos, which is pretty exciting. People are becoming much more aware.
What do you think, from studying this, what would you think is actually going on?
Okay, people ask me that all the time, and I have to admit, I don't know what they are, but I know that they are, and that it's time we get this topic out in the open. That's such an important component of all this, and address it, accept it, and study it so we can find out who's driving these things. And not only that, but also move forward in our own evolution. Because who's ever doing this, is certainly in their own gentle way, and I have to say this too, this is really important, in over 17 years, and I can't speak for other things, but in 17 years there has not been not one report of harm, threat, or abduction associated with the Phoenix Lights. I can only focus on the Phoenix Lights, but it has changed people forever. And that's really an important component of this too. That's a whole other conversation on how it transformed people in a positive way, not only in real time, but long term. And that also is a very important component. And that's where the whole evolution consciousness process sets in, because who's ever doing this is not only waking us up to their presence in a very gentle, non-threatening way, but they're also waking us up to the fact that we're not alone in the universe.
Okay. In your book, you actually make some comparisons to near-death experiences, and Kenneth Ring had written a book back in the late 80s doing the same thing, showing some of the commonalities. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's also a really, really intriguing new road that I went on as I was investigating all this, because a number of witnesses had near-death experiences as children that was reawakened by the mass sighting. And I found that very profound, because I did too. And in my book, I lay it all out there, and I tell about my near-death experience as an 8-year-old and how it changed my life forever. And when I kept hearing this from several of the witnesses, I thought, geez, could there possibly be a connection between all unexplained phenomena, whether it's near-death experience, out-of-body experience, or unexplained aerial phenomena that have a mystical light associated with the experience? And lo and behold, again, when I started looking, I started finding very credible studies being done at university level. The Omega Project at University of Connecticut by Dr. Kenneth Ring. And there's like a 4-inch thick book about the connection, as well as Dr. Raymond Fowler, who did the Andreessen case, as well as a number of others throughout the United States and world that have been studying the connection. And I lay it out very simply in the book. Not only is the experience very similar, whatever the unexplained phenomena is, and I start calling them UPS, a UP, an unexplained phenomena, an UP, because not only is the experience very similar, but the after effect. That is what is most stunning, because the awakening, the enlightenment that happens to an individual who experiences an UP experience changes their life forever. The connectedness to the universe and to the earth and to each other is really felt a lot, most times for the first time in their life, at a very, very deep level. And it changes people forever.
Yeah, and I think the after effects are definitely really interesting. It's also interesting when Whitley Strieber has reported people having abduction experiences and seeing dead relatives during it.
Right, exactly. I talk about that in the book. I mean, there, and Whitley does talk about it as well, is that there is some kind of a connection, some kind of a correlation, which is so intriguing and fascinating and really needs to be studied. So, I hope it'll perk somebody else. In fact, now that the book and the documentary have lives of their own, I am now working and getting back to my true passion on a curriculum for youth from 4th to 12th grade called Out of the Box, The Adventures of Sue, F-O, Field Observer, and Hugh, H-U-G-H, U-F-O, and he's the alien. And I'm working with wonderful teachers. Kate Hooker is an amazing teacher here in Phoenix who really has such an understanding of the topic, as well as her middle school kids, and a Disney illustrator, Mar Makis, who just does an incredible job with the illustrations. And we're moving forward with this. This is really going to be groundbreaking, so I'll keep you posted. It's a gentle overview, just as the documentary is for the general public, for youth, to introduce them to the topic, because they thirst. They thirst for this knowledge. And it really became very clear after I came forward in 2004 and was approached after I came out with the book. I was approached by filmmakers, and I wanted to do something so badly visually, but I was working 7 to 7 at the Arizona Heart Institute and doing radio programs like This Into the Night and Barnes & Noble and Borders book tours on the weekend. And I was invited by parents who saw me at one of the Barnes & Noble presentations to a middle school here. And I walked in, there were 200 students in this auditorium. You could hear a pin drop. And they were on the edge of their chairs. And I realized that there is nothing, and I mean nothing, in our history books about this topic. And that really prompted me to do the documentary, and we started production with Steve Lance, who is an amazing, amazing filmmaker. It was just the two of us. We did it together. And by this was in May, and by June, we were overwhelmed with just the most incredible interviews. And I had to make a choice, and I made a choice to continue with the documentary. And I have to tell you, I haven't looked back. 12, over a dozen international film festival awards later, and now I'm really concentrating on the curriculum. So I'll keep you apprised of our progress.
All right. And the documentary, where is that available?
The book and the documentary are in stores, as well as Amazon.com. And Barnes & Noble, Amazon really has the best discount, particularly currently, and Kindle as well, and it's on Nook, and you can get it through our website as well. But the book and documentary are out there, and I hope people will just take a look at it and decide for themselves. Everybody comes from a different background, from a different upbringing, from a different belief system. Some people can't deal with this topic, and some people just don't want to, and that's okay. That's okay. Everyone in their own time. But if you want to learn and grow and see what the Phoenix Lights is all about, I welcome you to pick up the book and the documentary and to join us on the Phoenix Lights Network Facebook page, and please come to the 2014 MUFON International Symposium. It's going to be great fun.
And the book is The Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery That We Are Not Alone. What is the name of the documentary?
Actually, we have several versions.
Oh, okay.
The first one is The Phoenix Lights, We Are Not Alone. And the latest one is The Phoenix Lights, Beyond Top Secret. And what's interesting is on that particular DVD, I put one of the craft that people described, which blew me away, because it wasn't until months later when I really started delving into the history that I discovered that 1 month before the Arizona mass sighting of March 13, 1997, there was actually a mass sighting in St. Petersburg, Russia, on February 19th, 1997. And a couple people got video, and I'm going to share that at the conference. And one of the videos is identical to one of the crafts that people described in Arizona a month later. So, I don't know, that really got to me. But that was it's very different. Each light is actually three lights. And there's a video from St. Petersburg that's the same exact thing.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what do you think the most misunderstood thing about this is?
I think that number one, as soon as somebody just blows the Phoenix Lights off as flares, I have to giggle because I know that they have not looked at the data. And that includes skeptics or debunkers or whoever. That's the only thing that I say. I mean, the data is there. It speaks for itself. I just urge people to actually look at it and decide for themselves.
Okay. All right. And you have another conference coming up as well?
I do. I'm going to be presenting as well at the Contact in the Desert conference in August, and I'm actually going to be getting into more of the consciousness side of the Phoenix Lights and unexplained phenomena up experiences. So that'll be really really fun too. I'll be speaking on August the 8th at Contact in the Desert. So I appreciate you mentioning that. Yeah, it's really a thrill and an honor to be able to share the information with those that want to hear it, because it's really helping to raise awareness worldwide that something is going on, that something has been going on that is outside of our reality cube, and the more people that open up to it, and that's the first step, is just being open to these phenomena and these experiences. The more we'll learn and grow as a civilization, as beings on this planet. So, and by the way, I do have to share this too, that whether it's near-death experience or contact, there is a very, very profound message that people come back with time and time again. And it's not just the Phoenix Lights. It's all unexplained phenomena, but certainly it has happened here with the Phoenix Lights as well, is to wake up. Whoever's doing this is trying to wake us up to what we're doing to the planet and ourselves before it's too late. And if that's not an important reason to come forward, I don't know what is. So I hope that people will learn and grow and really take stock and that we're not alone in the universe, and that we can really make this world a better world.
And how do you think the media has changed since the Phoenix Lights happened in 97 to now? Have you seen the media change drastically and in the way it approaches these things?
Well, actually, when, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, when I first came forward, and actually from day one, the TV media here, because one reporter in particular had actually seen the mass sighting himself, and he wanted to get to the bottom of it, and he did some incredible reports, which I'll be sharing at the MUFON International Symposium, and very credible, very professional. There was no laughing or snickering or music playing or little green men. The only time that there was any kind of ostracizing, and certainly there has been, you know, certainly in the United States for years, and certainly at the very beginning, the witnesses that came forward, as well as Councilwoman Frances Barwood, when she came forward, really got plastered by the media. I was very content to keep anonymous for 7 years, doing my own homework. And in those 7 years, particularly when I finally came forward and people realized that, after having done, you know, medical reporting in the early 80s, they really accepted what I was doing with open arms. I didn't get any flack at all. I mean, they were actually excited that somebody was coming forward to lend credibility to the topic, and they knew that I wouldn't have come forward if I didn't do my homework, and I didn't think it was important to do so. So I've been really, really fortunate in that behalf, and I have done, you know, shows worldwide. I mean, National Geographic a few times, as well as Travel Channel, History Channel, and so forth. And, you know, I really try to vet whoever is going to be interviewing me and let them know this is not a joke. And if they want to take it as a joke, or they want to do any kind of debunking or discrediting, which is very scary, you know, in this day and age, you know, that I'm not interested. And I have turned down quite a number of things, and happy that I did, because the shows turned out to be a debunking tool. But, you know, it's really been a joy for me and a wondrous adventure, and just going with the flow, and we'll see where it leads. But in the meantime, the information is there if people want to take a look at it, and I hope they do.
All right. And the website one more time?
Is the Phoenix Lights Network, Phoenix Lights Network, www.thephoenixlights.net. And also Phoenix Lights Network Facebook page. Please join us there. I post at least weekly updates. And there's phenomena happening, very similar phenomena happening worldwide all the time. So, you know, I welcome people to come there as well.
All right. And we've been talking with Dr. Lynn Kitai, and we'll say Kitai. Kitai, author of The Phoenix Lights, A Skeptic's Discovery of We Are Not Alone. And if you're interested, she'll be speaking at the MUFON Symposium in 2 weeks on July 19th. And that's where?
That's at the Crown Plaza Resort Hotel in Cherry Hill, New Jersey.
All right. I thank you so much for spending some time with us.
Oh, thank you for letting me share. And I say this to people all the time. Keep looking up.
Come in. Understand the numbers pouring over your connection to perfection. 5, 8, 3. Have you heard the singing soaking into our transmission? 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. Can you hear the ballet? Church of the Universe, Venture Calls and Tatriot, Chambers number 1597, and counting. And counting. Can you hear?